You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Episode 95, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. And today's expert is Professor Gabriela Gomez. Dr. Gomez is a mathematician at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow, Scotland, and along with her colleagues from around the world, have written an incredibly provocative paper dealing with COVID and herd immunity. As you might know, traditionally, herd immunity is believed to require 60 to 80% of the population to have some immunity either through vaccination or prior infection to prevent large pandemic epidemic spreads. Every disease has a different threshold, some more, some less, based on its infectivity. And so the thought with COVID, with its R-naught of 2 to 2.5, that it would require 60 to 80%. Well, Dr. Gomez and her group came to the conclusion that actually it's probably between 10 to 20%. They base this on data and science that they've accumulated over the years, and they've used this same modeling for a number of years now in modeling other epidemics and breakouts, things like malaria, tuberculosis, and have found that it's actually much more common for the herd immunity to be significantly lower than we originally thought, simply because there's a significant heterogeneity within our population. This simply means that we're all different. And whether this difference is due to genetics, hygiene, diet, or something else is hard to say. But the fact of the matter is, not everyone is equally susceptible to getting a disease. And once the susceptibility of a population drops beneath a certain point, you've reached herd immunity. This does not mean, of course, that the cases go to zero, but the fact that you don't have these large outbreaks that we're having now. So I think this is going to be the first part of the discussion. I'll have another one in maybe next week or the week after. We're going to sort of tie all this stuff together. But I think this is a very positive, hopeful message, and one that I think is being borne out by the current data. Now, as with any model, it's just a model. And so it's entirely possible that this will be found to be inaccurate or that it doesn't play out the way that Dr. Gomez believes. However, she thinks with seeing the data that we've seen so far and her prior experience with other infections, that her model is very robust and will stand the test of time. One can only hope, because her prediction is that this burns itself out very soon. And wouldn't that be great? I would really suggest that if you don't subscribe to the show, make sure you do so. Go back to past episodes, and if you have missed some or would like to catch up on some of the things we discussed, certainly go back and listen to those. I don't think you'd be disappointed. Continue sharing with your friends and family. That's what's helped lend to the success of the show and our show being invited onto the Doctors Podcast Network, which should launch by the end of this year, but certainly soft launch earlier in the fall. I would also like to highly encourage you to review the paper that Dr. Gomez wrote. They'll be linked at the show notes page at theparadox.com/095. That's theparadocs.com. That link, a number of other links to previous episodes on COVID and ways to contact and follow Dr. Gomez will be there as well. And I think these are all important things because if you want to start getting into discussion with other people, if you're some policymaker, if you just want some non-doom and gloom when it comes to COVID, I think this is really a great paper to read and review. And it's interesting, I think, to see the science behind it and the mathematics, whether you understand it or not. And I'll admit, I'm not as adept at mathematics as I once was when I was an engineer back way back when in college. But without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Gabriela Gomez of the University of Strathclyde, professor in mathematics and modeler of epidemics. Enjoy. Welcome. I'm here with my new friend, Dr. Gabriela Gomez, a professor of mathematics statistics at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland. And we're going to be discussing a paper that she recently wrote regarding COVID. So we're back to the COVID subject. So I hope you enjoyed your respite for a few weeks, listeners. But we're back to COVID, and we're going to talk about herd immunity. So Dr. Gomez, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be speaking here.
Well, in the magic of the internet and the Zoom and online meetings, you're actually, although you teach in Scotland, you're, as we were talking earlier, you're in Portugal, your home country, and I'm obviously in the United States, and we're somehow magically able to talk instantaneously across the world, which I think has made this pandemic a little bit easier to sort of handle, that we can still remain socially active and interacting where we couldn't before.
Yeah, I feel I'm becoming a lot more agile at these things. And, you know, I can imagine 10 years ago, I really hated having a conference call or something like that, but now it's just become natural.
It is funny how this, in fact, I was reading a novel just the other day about, and they're talking, there's a detective trying to solve some crime, and he had read that there was some city in Italy he had to find, and so he went to the bookstore and got some maps and kind of had an idea where, what part of the country he was in, and eventually figured out where the town was. I thought, well, it's funny, because now, I mean, that was only 15 years ago. Now you wouldn't even think twice. Within 5 seconds, you know exactly where the town is. You could find, you know, what restaurants are, what their hours are and everything. And it's the connectivity of the world has changed so dramatically. It's I think that probably ties a little bit into COVID, right? I think sort of what's happened is partly because we are so much more connected than we have been in the past.
And we are also very connected without being physically connected. And that was part of the solution. There was a big component in the solution to handling this pandemic. We could be socially distant, but still be in contact with people, the people we needed to, we wanted to.
Right. And so that, you know, we're again talking beforehand a little bit about your collaboration, your paper. You've collaborated with people from all over the world, something that would not have been easily done 25 years ago, but we're able to obtain knowledge from all of the countries from all over the world as we sort of try and get our handle on what this pandemic is and COVID. So why don't we begin with your paper that you wrote, and it'll be linked in the show notes at theparadox.com. Why don't you talk about what's your, I guess, your working hypothesis for herd immunity, because we're going to talk about that today.
Yeah, so the way we started tackling this COVID epidemic in terms of analyzing it was it results from the last 10 years of research in my group. So about, I've worked on epidemic modeling for about 20 years now, but there was a change in the way I approached it 10 years ago. And that's when I realized how important it was to include individual variation in our models. So I just became, whether I studied malaria or tuberculosis or influenza or now COVID, I think I'm going to build this model, and where am I going to put this distribution of individual susceptibility or individual connectivity that became a core component of all the models we do. So at the beginning, when the pandemic started, I was actually moving institutions from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine to the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow. So I didn't have a group at that time. So I didn't have a team to work with me, and I was intrigued by this pandemic. I wanted to analyze it. I wanted to start modeling it, and I got in touch with my former students and former collaborators who are all in different parts of the world now, and we started doing this together. We started sort of having our meetings over the computer, because we were not physically in the same place, and we implemented this model, and very quickly we started realizing that the epidemic would be much smaller than the homogeneous models were suggesting at the time if we included individual variation, if we included a level of individual variation compatible with what we had included in diseases we had studied before. Of course, we had not studied COVID before, but we had our estimates of individual variation in tuberculosis and malaria, and we included the same levels of individual variation in COVID COVID, assuming that was a big assumption, considered a big assumption at the time, considering that the humans are as variable in their susceptibility to COVID as they are in their susceptibility to tuberculosis and malaria, then we would get herd immunity thresholds around 10 to 20% rather than over 60% like the more classical models were suggesting.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's the, when the first discussion on COVID came, there was the talk, well, with a fairly infectious agent with coronavirus 19, that you need to get 60 to 80% of the population to have immunity to this to prevent large scale spreading and growth to where you saw in areas like Northern Italy specifically, or New York City. We've seen in other countries, any cities in the United States as well, and as other parts of the world. But your assumption then is that 10 to 20% is, you know, completely different, right? I mean, this is a profoundly different threshold, and one that can be met relatively quickly in the sense that, you know, if you want to get 60 or 80% of the population to have this, have gotten immunity to it, you're anticipating what happened in New York City to happen, say, four times. And so you'd have four times the deaths and, you know, the sort of the surge on the healthcare services. And so the use that mentioned that the biggest assumption, and there are a number of assumptions we'll go over through, but the biggest one is that there's individual variation. And this is, I guess, to make it simply for the listeners, this is just the assumption that some people are more likely to get it than others when you have the same exposure from the same person, right? I mean, so this is, and you will see this for most diseases, like even like a common cold, some people in the family catch it and others don't. And there's no good reason except that for whatever reason, some people have better immune systems. It's all kind of, we sort of chalk it up to.
Yeah, and it's actually, I think we can understand it mechanistically. Why is it that this individual variation leads to this difference in herd immunity thresholds and in the expected size of epidemics? So if we consider our susceptibility, at the beginning, we had a totally susceptible population. So we didn't assume that anyone was not susceptible. Everyone in our model population were susceptible, but some individuals were a lot more susceptible than others. And we had our model included an abstract distribution of susceptibility that depended on a parameter. So the way the model is formalized is that this distribution is abstract. It's characterized by a mean and a coefficient of variation. Mm-hmm. And then we fit this model to epidemics as they develop, and we estimate the typical parameters, the typical epidemiological parameters, like the R naught, the basic reproduction number, which is the average number of secondary cases attributed to each infected individual. And so we estimate R naught, but in our model differs from other models that are being developed in that we also estimate the coefficient of individual variation. So it's just like a parameter, another parameter that our model, an extra parameter that our model has that we estimate by fitting the model to epidemics. And so if we see, we can do this exercise, we see that if we simulate our model with coefficient of variation zero, we have a very large epidemic. If we simulate it again with a coefficient of variation equal to one, we have a smaller epidemic. And the larger this coefficient of variation is, the smaller the epidemic happens to be. So, and why is this? So if we have a heterogeneous population, the individuals that are infected first, early in the epidemic, are the individuals who are most susceptible or most exposed. So these individuals get infected, they develop some immunity, some total or partial or lifelong or short-lived, it doesn't matter. They develop some level of immunity. And in developing that immunity, they are removed from the susceptible pool. So they are no longer available for the virus to infect. So the individuals that remain available to the virus are the individuals that all along had less susceptibility. So the virus becomes less able to infect because the individuals that remain susceptible are not as susceptible as the ones that were it infected before, and so this decelerates the growth of the epidemics, and makes the herd immunity threshold easier to achieve. So that's the mechanism that's the intuition behind the results that we find.
And I guess, you know, one of the things when you say the individual variation with susceptibility is not necessarily just involved with the individual and sort of their ability to not get infected for whatever reason, but also the fact that they may not be putting themselves at exposure, right? I mean, this part of the individual variation is some people may stay at home more, or they may avoid more social interactions and contact. Is that correct?
Yeah, it can be that as well. We actually formulate two models, and because mathematically these two processes are a bit different. So heterogeneity in susceptibility is just it just means what it says. So some individuals are more likely than others to acquire the infection. But when we say heterogeneity in exposure, the individuals that are more exposed, that means that have more contacts with other individuals, they are not only more likely to acquire infection, but they are also more likely to pass it on to others. So mathematically, this is a slightly different model. But we applied both models, and the actual we actually developed some hybrid models that combine these two, and we applied these different models to the epidemics, to the data that is coming from the epidemics as they unfold, and we get very similar estimates of the coefficient of the herd immunity threshold. So despite the model differences, it seems like the herd immunity threshold is a rather conserved quantity. That you know, different models tell us, as long as they have the right amount of variation, they indicate the same herd immunity thresholds, and the amount of the variation that we put in these models is not an assumption. We actually, it's by fitting the model to the epidemic curves that we estimate the coefficients of variation, like we estimate R0, and having the coefficient of variation and R0, there is a simple formula that tells us what is the herd immunity threshold given those estimated parameters.
So when you're looking at you looked at four countries, if I recall, in the model, the England, Belgium, Spain, and Portugal. And then I assume, well, I mean, the reaction of the virus has been different in all those countries. I mean, I think Belgium is one of the worst hit in the world as far as deaths per million or however they're calculating. But so did you find that even with all the different responses, they're pretty much the same within the same sort of limits of 10 to 20%?
Yeah, actually, the country where we estimated the herd immunity threshold to be lowest among these four countries was in Portugal. So it's about 10, and sometimes a bit less than 10, depending on exactly what model to use. And in England, we estimated 20%. That was the highest of all the four countries, and Belgium and Spain, we estimate something in between. And actually, it's interesting, the reason why England seems to have a higher herd immunity threshold than the other three countries is that it you know, our estimates say that the coefficient of variation is smaller. So it looks like the population in England is less variable than the populations in south of Europe or in Belgium, which could be this could be telling us about something cultural, maybe. I don't know, I haven't really think about it beyond this, but it's quite interesting and maybe interesting to investigate in the future.
So it could be, so you're saying the variability could be a genetic thing, or it could be the fact that it's more densely populated, or that people just behave differently. For instance, there was a discussion that maybe Italy was worse because greeting people, you're kissing people as opposed to shaking hands or just waving, and that your ability to, you know, so that's a cultural difference that may cause the more likely to have, you know, you need a higher threshold because of the way people interact with each other.
Yeah, that may cause a higher R0, but it may also cause higher variation because... you kiss and hug more people, but not everybody. It's just people you know better. So that creates variation as well. Right. So doesn't only create more transmission, but more variation as well. And even biological differences, part of it could be genetic differences that make some people more susceptible than others. But it could also be the history of their life history, somehow their experiences that they live throughout life, which although it may actually become appear like a biological difference, it may be a biological difference that developed because of social and cultural differences. I find it quite interesting. Right now, I've only been using these to make the models more accurate, but it actually makes you think, and maybe you'll give rise to other
sure.
projects.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's the hardest thing when it comes to epidemiology is controlling for. Proving causation is always the hardest thing in any sort of studies, right? And when you have something like this. You say, well, there's dietary differences, there's genetic differences, there are, you know, age differences in age of populations in general. There's the cultural differences as far as, you know, how people move around, the density, you know, what the nutritional, you know, state is of people. And so there's so many different things that could enter into this that it'd be very hard just, I mean, there could be a lot of work a lot of papers could be written in the future on this subject. You know, one of the things that people talk about with COVID, and they think that is a large contributor to these especially many epidemics that occur in regions or cities, is the notion of the super spreaders, and that people who, for whatever reason, they tend to be very efficient at getting other people sick, whether that's them spewing more virus per breath than the average person or something like that. Does your model take that into account, or does it not really make a difference because it just assumes that those people are sort of everywhere, equally distributed?
I think that's maybe captured by our heterogeneous connectivity model. So in our, we have one model that is heterogeneity in susceptibility that doesn't have that, but the other model that has heterogeneity in connectivity, the individuals that have a higher degree of contacts, the individuals that have more contacts, they may be super spreaders. They may be appear as super spreaders for those kinds of studies. So they, of course, they could also be super spreaders for different reasons, maybe because they were biologically more infectious. And but I think if what I read from groups that study that in particular by following contacts and how many people each person infected. So there are studies that are trying to measure that, and they seem to attribute that characteristic of super spreading to having more contacts rather than having more infectiousness. But I don't know. So it may be partly included in our models.
Well, and you know, this is something that I've been feeling for a while, and I mean, so much you're just operating on hunches, right? And because until we see this all play out, you don't know how it's going to play out, right? We haven't seen the ending of this film. And I certainly felt somewhat comforted in the fact that we've not had large second wave epidemics in areas that have been hit hard initially. I just look at the United States, New York got hit really hard initially, and it has really had almost, I don't want to say nothing, but really virtually no problems since that initial big wave hit. And they estimate 15-20% of the population has probably been exposed to COVID in that the city and the urban area, at least a metropolitan area, New York and New Jersey. And then there's a German study, I think, that came out that suggested that even people who were taking serum from people from 5 years ago or so, 4 or 5 years ago, when exposed to COVID, obviously they'd never seen COVID before because it didn't exist. And yet, even though they're exposed to COVID, their white cells or T cells actually formed an immune response to COVID-19, suggesting there's some cross reactivity with previous exposure to maybe other coronaviruses or some other virus that may explain why some people seem totally fine when they get this and others get really sick, right? But it also, that would, I guess, lend credence to the fact that it adds a lot more individual variability and the ability to hit a threshold, the herd immunity threshold, at a much lower number than the suggested, you know, assuming everybody had, this is totally novel and no one had ever, and everyone's equally susceptible.
Yeah, that's part exposure to other viruses, to other coronaviruses is one potential source of this individual, one potential factor for this individual variation that we see. We talked about genetics, we talk about previous history, that's part of the previous history, you know, being exposed to viruses that our immune system may see as similar somehow and cross react. But I think one I think a very important consequence, I hope, of this, of coming up with these herd immunity thresholds that are much lower, is that we can actually talk about what to do. We can actually have a constructive debate of, you know, what's the best way to overcome the rest of this pandemic. It's not over yet, but yeah, it may be more than halfway over. And, you know, what's the best way to lead things to the end in the safest possible way for everybody? When we were thinking about the herd immunity threshold of 70%, it was just daunting. It's just that right. We can't do anything. This is so bad. It's going to last so long. It's going to be so devastating. What can we do? And then it created these polarized views in the just among people in general, but also in scientific community and that was not very helpful, I think. So if we think it's 20% in some places, 10 in others, are we there? Maybe not yet, but what's the best way to get there? It may be soon, it may be by the end of this year in many places. I don't know. I hope people appreciate that. I really thought it was I really thought this was going to be very welcome, and our approach and our results and our conclusions were going to be very welcome. Then I don't know. I just I'm getting very sort of refractory reactions, mainly from the scientific community. That's been a bit sad to see, because, you know, we just want to be constructive. We just want people to get interested and help us. We are not going to solve everything by ourselves. There's lots of complementary studies that can be done that will help to be more conclusive, to establish this causality.
Yeah, well, and that's the other half of it, right? I mean, the one is to say, well, we know we need 20%, let's say even 25%. To say the high end for maybe some other countries you didn't study, but how do you get there? What do you think the role of vaccination is? Because, you know, that there seem to be many, and I don't know what it's like in Portugal, but here in the United States, it is so politicized. There are some people who are resting their laurels on vaccination, which we don't know when that'll happen, if it occurs, how effective it'll be. What effect does that have on herd immunity? I mean, because in some ways you're going to be immunizing people who, I guess, according to your model, are not worth immunizing because they would not be susceptible anyway, or right? I mean, do you have to immunize a larger portion of people than you would ordinarily? Because I guess then you would have to, people need to get infected. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's also, who to immunize is actually a question to answer that question, you also, so it's good to have an accurate idea of what the herd immunity threshold is and how far we are from it. If we were very far from the herd immunity threshold, and if we recognize that is individual variation in the population, you'd probably want to vaccinate those people that are more susceptible or more likely to get the infection, or more exposed, like more likely to get the infection, because that would help you more to reach the herd immunity. And if you reach herd immunity, then you protect everybody. But if herd immunity is lower, and if we are almost there, really the priority must be to vaccinate the people who are at higher risk of having the more severe symptoms. Although you may want to vaccinate those anyway, whether you choose to vaccinate to herd immunity, you may also at the same time decide to vaccinate people at higher risk to develop severe symptoms if they get infected. But it's a different logic, and we can discuss, we can debate, because it's something that is manageable. It's in our reach. It's a problem that we can solve. I confess I was finding it a bit depressing to think that, you know, we have this massive epidemic, and the only way to get to get out of it is to vaccinate almost everybody, is to have a vaccine, vaccinate almost everybody, right. But we don't know when the vaccine is going to be here. So what to do? Right. Well, I don't know.
Yeah, we're sort of left with no options, right? Except just to hide for 1 to 2 to 3 years, and which is not feasible for most people. I mean, you don't realize how important social interactions are until they're taken away from you. I think, you know, even if I consider myself fairly introverted, and yet it is, I found it pretty challenging where I would suddenly, I'd linger around at work extra hours because just, you know, it's an opportunity to talk to someone and just visit with someone. And I notice all kinds of people doing this too. And ordinarily we sort of, when we're done with work, we just kind of head home, and now everyone's just congregating and hanging out, you know, speaking for a little while. So what do you, with the scientific community sort of working things out, and I think, you know, this is something that people don't recognize who don't follow science much, and I admit I'm not, don't follow science a ton, but I do recognize that it's always evolving. There's always a lot of dispute, and scientific consensus is not reached upon quickly, especially in the midst of the fog of sort of war here, is we don't really know anything about this virus as we're all sort of learning. Do you find that people are, the resistance comes from people, other people who are modeling, or do you think it's people who have, who are committed to a certain path, and that's why they're so hostile to the notion that maybe herd immunity is not a million miles away, and that we're actually maybe potentially closer than other, than what do you think the resistance and the problems right now are within the scientific community?
I think for some reason, I think it's people connected with public health and in general, including lab-based like immunologists, or including epidemiologists, and including social sciences, you know, people that somehow are connected are involved in public health research in some way. And as if they feel they, in order to protect people, they cannot let them know that herd immunity threshold is almost here, because it could, that could trigger less careful behaviors, and people could expose themselves more if they thought the problem is not as big as they originally thought. I think it may actually work the opposite way. I think if you tell people that, you know, we have this pandemic, it's very bad. People can get very sick if they get it, but it will be over by the end of the year. So you just have to follow what the government says. You just have to follow the rules that are being set out, because there's this team of experts who are sort of designing the strategies and to get us out of this as safely as possible within months. And people are probably more willing to follow the rules and to be part of this strategy than if they are told this is a big problem, it's going to last 3 or 4 years. And we are just—we don't even know how to develop a proper strategy for it to develop, to last all this time. Maybe there's going to be a vaccine that will save us. And I don't see why telling people. I should quite the opposite. I think telling people that this lasts. Sort of manageable time frame, something they can cope to make a sacrifice for 6 months. They may be, people may be willing to make a sacrifice for 6 months that may not be willing to take for 4 years. So I think it's good to know that if it's true that it's plausible that it may last only 6 months, six more months. So, yeah, I think we should tell people.
Understand complicated mathematics. They don't need to understand, you know, the whole herd immunity as far as the coefficient of variability and all those sorts of things. But you can, if you give people a roadmap and you give them a reasonable time frame and say we expect that it to be done, it's the open-ended nature of things that makes it really difficult to plan. You know, people who are going to get married, and now do they have to wait 1 year, 2 years to have a wedding or things like that, or to have children? There are a lot of things that you put on hold, and you can't put them on hold indefinitely, and so it causes a lot of resentment. And at least in our country, we had officials saying, don't wear masks, even though they knew that people should wear masks probably, but we didn't have enough. And so instead of saying, there aren't enough masks, make sure people in the hospitals have masks, they said, don't wear masks. And so then when they asked people to wear masks later, people were like, well, you can't send mixed messages like this. And I think the WHO was also responsible for that sort of behavior. How do we, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, or if you are, just another example of that, if you are an adolescent and someone tells you you are going to be like this for 4 years, like, you know, I had this conversation with one of my nephews and said, well, in 4 years, I won't be an adolescent anymore. So I will have lost completely my adolescence. And you know, if you tell them it's only 6 months, they say, okay, maybe this summer is going to be a bit funny, but then, you know, then next summer will be, I'll make up for it.
Yeah. Although you worry about adolescents doing, you know, working, making up for things in 6 months, but yeah, I mean, you hate to take away someone's youth, especially when and so I guess you get the behaviors you'd expect, right? That if you say we're gonna take it away forever, like, well, I guess I might as well not bother doing anything. I might as well just go and do what I want at this point. So I guess the proof in the pudding is always, is it true, right? So how do we know when that your model is more accurate than the models that came out earlier that were saying, you know, global devastation, you know, morgues will get filled up, we'll have to, you know, dig mass graves and things like that. And how do we know that your model is correct, that the herd immunity is really 10-20%, that we're going to have, that we can, that other scientists will feel comfortable saying, well, maybe we need to relook at our initial sort of, you know, really terrible models?
Yeah, I think our model is more compatible with the data at this point. I think we can say that. When I couldn't say that in early May, when we first started discussing and presenting our results, and we, you know, people were doubtful that the effect would be so large as we were saying, and I didn't insist much at the time. We had a first preprint at that time. Our first preprint was posted at the end of April. And you know, my arguments then were, well, but we have this is the magnitude of variation that we see for malaria, for tuberculosis. So it seems reasonable, it is reasonable to assume the same magnitude of variation for COVID. And if we assume that variation for COVID, then we get this herd immunity thresholds 10 to 20%. And it was challenging because people say, well, but how about if COVID is totally different, right? and variation is less, variation is much less, then you won't get that large effect that you are suggesting. And okay, and I just continue doing our work. And then it was very striking that as more data became available, then support for our initial estimates was becoming stronger and stronger. And especially when when lockdowns were being lifted, social distancing measures were being relaxed, and the homogeneous models just wanted to have cases increasing. So according to a homogeneous model, as soon as you lift the social distance, as soon as you relax social distances, the cases start going up again very soon. And according to our model, no, they kept going down. And it was this phase of the epidemic that enabled us to estimate, I think with a high level of confidence, the coefficients of variation that we now have in our models, that, by the way, are similar to those we had estimated for tuberculosis and malaria over the last few years. So it's similar. And with those coefficients of variation, we really do get herd immunity thresholds between 10 and 20%. Yeah. It could be a bit more or a bit less if you look at smaller regions. If you do subnational studies, then you can get regional herd immunity thresholds that may be much higher or much lower if you are in a big city or if you are in a small village, of course.
Sure. To be clear, then, this is your model is one that works not just with COVID, because of course we don't know for sure. But if you look at, we place it for other infectious diseases, you see the same pattern and the same thresholds work for other diseases. Are other epidemiologists? Do they? Well, you're not an epidemiologist, so I should say. So, do epidemiologists? Is that sort of almost too new a concept for them to agree with, or you know, how was your work received a couple of years ago before this new pandemic?
Yeah, so I think epidemiologists are very well aware that heterogeneity is very important. It makes models behave different. So there's a high recognition for the importance of heterogeneity in models. The difficulty is how to measure it. And because I think usually what people think, and I see when people ask me questions about how I measure this heterogeneity, and I say, I don't measure it. We just put it in the model as a parameter, and then we fit this model to the data, and the best fit tells us what is the coefficient of variation. So we don't know what the specific factors are. We don't try to measure specific factors. Because I think the approach has been, if we build a model, if we want to build a model with heterogeneity and susceptibility, we have to enumerate which factors we think that are most important for that variation in susceptibility, let's say genetics, or let's say innate immunity, let's say exposure to other coronavirus. And the mindset is that you'd have to go and measure that. You'd have to measure the importance of genetics in individual, in how much genetics contributes to this individual variation, how much exposure to other coronavirus accounts for this individual variation, how much innate immunity and so on, nutrition or whatever other factors. And that's almost prohibitively difficult to do, and you couldn't do that in a short time frame in an emergency like for this pandemic, and that's, it's there that our approach differs, is that we are not going to try to estimate all these factors and then try to compose a distribution that takes all those factors into account. We are just going to admit that we couldn't possibly do that in a useful time frame. So we just put it this abstractly as a parameter in our model, and we are going to fit the model with that parameter in it to the epidemics, and we are going to estimate that parameter. And then we have a parameterized model that we can use to make projections, and we think it makes more accurate projections because it actually did a better fit to the data that of the epidemic so far.
Right, and in medicine we see this all the time in the sense that we have a new pharmacologic agent that's introduced for, say, treating cancer. We don't know exactly why it works, why a chemotherapeutic agent works in one person and doesn't another. We just know that, say, in 60% of the people, you get an extra year of survival or something like that. Certainly later on, you can try and find genetic reasons or some sort of individual variation that causes a drug to be more effective or less effective in an individual, and then you can tailor the medications and your treatment. But initially, you just know sort of the averages, right? And so you don't know. And so when you go to a patient, you can't tell them this will work 100%, this will work zero. You can just give them a number, an average of how often it works without knowing individually how it's going to work. But you could say in a population, it's going to work this often from a previous experience. But again, we haven't figured out these specific factors or parameters that cause that.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, because the way we build all our models with this heterogeneity that may have the right level, we hope the right level of heterogeneity, but we don't know what causes it exactly. It serves the purpose of making the model more accurate and making, I hope, more reliable predictions. But it doesn't help you target interventions if you want it to, because you don't know who are those individuals who are more susceptible. Actually, we were talking before, and it's very relevant, we were talking before about vaccines. If you have a vaccine, and you may want to target it to those individuals who are more likely to get the infection. But if you don't know who they are, you can't do that yet. So we are not completely there yet. We are, when the need for that comes, we are not ready for that yet. That's why I think it would be really important to have other researchers, other groups who work with the different approaches from others, complementary approaches to ours, join this effort and address the next steps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this has been a very hopeful discussion, because I think, like you said, we've had this open-ended discussion or concern that this is going to last years and years. And I think an important point to mention this too is that even though you may not have, even once you hit herd immunity, it just means the virus is not growing in scale. It does not mean it goes away forever. And so there'll still be cases, just like there's not a pandemic of malaria, but there's still malaria, right? I mean, still malaria exists and people can get it. And obviously, once there are certain diseases that they're no longer epidemics, and but they can be still present in the community until you get adequate vaccination and protect enough individuals, you can theoretically get rid of it. Like smallpox would be a good example, or almost tuberculosis. And, you know, there are a couple of diseases we've almost gotten rid of through vaccinations, but it doesn't mean that, but we've at least gotten beyond the part where we're having epidemics and where it causes massive disruptions in our healthcare systems and, you know, our lives. And so it's probably important to point that out too, that even if you hit the threshold, it does not mean that coronavirus 19 just disappears, right? It's still around.
Yeah, yeah. I think the expectation is that the virus will continue as a seasonal virus, like many others, like all these seasonal virus that cause respiratory diseases in the winters. And also the threshold, and the reason why they are seasonal viruses is that you may, you know, one winter you may cross the threshold, or at some point you may be above threshold, but then you lose that status over time, because maybe more babies were born without that immunity, or maybe because immunity wanes and it's not long lived, or it's not lifelong. So eventually you will lose this pandemic may take us above the herd immunity threshold, but eventually we'll be below again, and there will be another epidemic, but typically much smaller. It won't be this huge disruption that we have.
Right, and I've talked to a number of people too who say it. The assumption is at some point this coronavirus becomes, as you were sort of mentioning, endemic. So it means it's always with us. It's around, and used with the usual courses of viruses when they become endemic is that eventually become fairly benign. When we have four other coronaviruses, it's entirely possible that at one point those strains were more virulent or more deadly, and now they just aren't anymore because they're more likely to survive and reproduce, since they if they don't kill off their hosts like this one is. And so, I mean, that would be probably what'll happen at some point. But those viruses also, adenoviruses, rhinovirus, coronavirus, which are endemic and are somewhat seasonal, but not always, but they can still kill you if you're old and weak and they can cause you can get other secondary infections. And so you can get a viral pneumonia. We just don't usually check to see what kind of virus most people get when they're elderly. And then they may succumb to it. And that's just sort of what happens. It's, you know, unfortunately life is a fatal disease. And so we all succumb to it at some point. Obviously you don't want it to cut people's lives short or to have extra suffering. So that's why we try and do everything we can to try eliminate this or minimize it. Any parting thoughts, or like what sort of where your research is going to go for the next 6 months? Are you going to try and reach out and to get more people to collaborate with you and to try and look at this model and see that it fits better than their models? Or, I mean, how do you sort of move forward at this point?
Yeah, well, we would like to apply it to other parts of the world. We are now working with colleagues in Brazil. The dynamics in the US, different dynamics in different states is also very interesting. I think it would be very interesting to try to address it with this model. And in Africa, it's just, I'm very intrigued about, you know, I hear that that in parts of Africa, the prevalence is reaching like 20% without major lockdown, because there's no resources for that. And then it just stops growing and it comes down. So I'd like to look at the, you know, very different applied model to very different parts of the world. And also, I don't know if people are interested to collaborate with us with complementary approaches, try to compare these distributions, these coefficients of variation that we are estimating, trying to see how that compares with when risk factors are measured directly. You know, in principle, our coefficient of variation should always be larger than the coefficient of variation for a single factor measured by other studies. But how do those other factors combine? Is it possible to identify a reasonably small number of factors and how they interact with each other to reconstruct our distributions, but in a more bottom-up way rather than our way, our approach that is more top down, perhaps. We just want to describe the, we want to describe the distribution, not construct it from basic principles. But it would be nice to see how the two things match. Eventually, when we have it all, it should match. They should make the same distribution.
Yeah, well, I mean, and a model is only as good as its assumptions and how good the assumptions are, right? I mean, so that's what you're always trying to refine, your coefficients and all those, all the variables in there, because, you know, if you're, something's way off, it can give you totally different results. And as you've seen from many of the models that people have introduced, whether it's climate change or with the pandemic, you see different conclusions to how it works, plays out at the end.
Yeah, another thing I would like to do it would be to look at other pandemics with this model, to look at the historical influenza pandemic of 1918, because that's, you know, we are constantly being confronted with that, with that, and say, well, what do their model say about that pandemic? Well, we haven't looked at it this way, so it's the first time that this kind of model is being used for, on a pandemic. So it would be nice to look at the previous ones and see whether the conclusions are similar to, and whether the conclusions change what is known, what is currently known about the influenza pandemic.
Right. And the tricky thing, of course, with that is historical data is really spotty. It's hard to know what, as far as, you know, the record keeping is not great. There weren't any tests for it specifically. So it pandemics, fortunately, they don't happen all that often. So because if it did, it'd be a lot easier to study this sort of thing, right? How do people find it? Obviously, your paper will be linked at the show notes page at theparadox.com/year95. What are ways for people to find out, follow more of what you're doing, and to keep track of your work?
I have a website at the University of Strathclyde, but it doesn't have much in it yet because I have just moved. So I'm afraid, I can send you the link to my website, and eventually when I have time, I will populate it with other projects.
Do you tweet? Are you out on Twitter or in social media?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. Yeah. I'm a bit new to Twitter, so sometimes it's a bit of a shock. And I get sort of this wave of questions and debate and so on. I say, what? But I think I'm getting used to it. Yeah, so I'm on Twitter.
It's a dangerous cesspool to swim around. What is your handle for Twitter?
So it's MGM Gomez 1.
Okay. Well, Dr. Gabriel Gomez from the University of Strathclyde, thank you so much for being on The Paradox. I really appreciate the discussion.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.